All right, well, thank you very much for coming. We are very pleased to brief you on the results of a poll taken by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs on American views of Japan as we prepare for our big election next week. There are copies of the poll report that you should have grabbed on your way in. If you don't have one, does everyone have one? Anyone need one? That's it. You want it, Yuko? Would you mind grabbing Yuko Nakano? Would you mind grabbing about 5 copies or 10 copies and coming back in? And if, I'll ask again. And I'm Michael Green, Japan Chair and Senior Advisor here at CSIS, and Associate Professor at Georgetown. And I was approached by the Chicago Council, who asked if I would help them design and interpret a poll on U.S. attitudes towards Japan as part of their larger surveys on American views of international affairs. Today what we'll do is I'll ask my friend and colleague Rachel Bronson from the Chicago Council to explain to you the methodology, the history of these polls, which many of you, I'm sure, have seen over the years by the Chicago Council. Some context in terms of what the overall polls have told us about how Japan compares to other countries. I will then go through with you the results and how we interpreted them. When I say we, I was the Japan expert who helped on this, but Rachel and Marshall Bouton and others have been doing this for a long time at the Chicago Council, and the interaction was fascinating for me between expert analysts of polls and someone who follows the Japan issues. And we reached consensus on our interpretation, but of course it is a presentation of the numbers and our interpretation. So to second-guess us a bit and take the conversation a bit further, we've invited Keiko Izuka from Yomiuri Shimbun to give some commentary at the end. So we'll begin with Rachel. Rachel Bronson is now at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She joined in January 2007 as the Vice President for Programs and Studies. Rachel was at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York before that. We overlapped for about a year or two as colleagues when I was at the Council. And in previous lives, she's also worked here at CSIS, has written some very important books on U.S. foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, and flew down from Chicago to join us today. Keiko Izuka is a rising star in the Yomiuri Shimbun. She's now at Brookings at the Center for North Asia. Is it Northeast Asia or North Asia? But CNAPS, not CNEPS, I guess, or CNAPS, Center for Northeast Asia Policy Studies, CNAPS, at Brookings. She's in the political department and has written on politics. She's been in the Prime Minister's office. The Conte has written quite a bit about Okinawa and U.S.-Japan security relations. So we'll ask her to give a fresh look at our interpretation. So let me turn it over first to Rachel. Then I'll go through the survey. We'll turn to Izuka-san. Then we'll open it for your reactions or questions.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and really thank you to Mike and CSIS for putting this together. We're pretty excited about these results and the report that Mike serves as the principal drafter on, and we're delighted to share it with you today. It's being released today as well. I wanted to give you a sense a little bit about this poll that we're going to talk about, because what Mike's going to talk about, the Japan part of it, is part of a larger effort. The Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which was originally called the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, has been running major polls on how Americans think about foreign policy since 1974. And even starting in 1974, was drawing on some questions that had been asked in other venues and fora since 1945. Now it's very common to be running regular polls, you know, every day. As soon as the presidential debates are over, the poll comes out. But what we think is important about this is both what we're asking, which are kind of deeper questions about foreign policy and where kind of Americans are feeling in general, but also the time series that we're able to put together, which is we can look at how attitudes change even on questions where there may be overwhelming support. Do Americans support treaties? Always overwhelmingly. But the key question then is kind of the trends. Is it increasing or decreasing? And I'll talk about some of that with you in a little bit. So the council has been running these every 4 years. In the last decade or so, or the last decade, we've compressed it, and now we're running them every 2 years. So instead of just running them on years of presidential elections, we do it all around the elections and the midterms as well. And it allows us to look deeply at these broader questions of what do you perceive as the vital threats to the United States? What do you perceive as key foreign policy goals? How do you feel about certain countries that Michael talked about a little bit more and is in the report? How interested is the public in foreign policy? And then we will also then begin to focus on emerging themes that Americans, so what's the thinking on immigration? And we'll really kind of cut into how Americans think about that. So in addition to the stock questions that we ask every 2 to 4 years, we also have started focusing on specific relationships or issues to do a deeper dive in. So in the past, we've looked at the transatlantic relationship. A couple years back, we looked at rise of China and India and how Americans were thinking about each of those countries and then both of those countries together in addition to our normal questions. And this year, our deep dive was on Japan, and we thought this was a very important relationship to look at, and then we got support from the Japan Foundation to do that, and we have them to thank for it, as well as the MacArthur Foundation, who supports the larger effort. In taking deep dives, it allows us to reach out to experts around the country and world to help us really think about what's the key question, and that's where we immediately reached out to Mike Green as the first on our list of if we could have anybody to help us on this, who would it be? And it was Mike, and we were delighted that Mike said yes, that he would help us with it. And as you look through it, those of you who follow Mike's writing, you will read a very familiar document as he was the principal author of that report. We looked at, what you have, I think, out back or somewhere, we've sent a number of the other reports, which we've done 4 releases, and this is the 4th. The other 3 is we did a very quick study on China right around the Olympics. But key is we look specifically at how Americans were thinking about foreign policy and how they were thinking about domestic policy. So those are 2, and I want to talk a little bit about that with you. To give some context to the Japan report and what Mike's about to talk about, what we saw in the poll is that Americans really are going through are looking for a change in their foreign politics and foreign policies. And so as the candidates talk about change, they are certainly reflecting something that Americans are saying that they're desiring, if you look policy by policy. So what do I mean by that? One of the key findings that we found was that Americans, by and large, endorse talking or engaging with enemies. So 70% of Americans think we should have some sort of engagement with Cuba. But for this audience, you know, 68% thought that there should be more engagement with North Korea. 65% thought there should be more engagement with Iran. And then 51 and 53% thought there should be engagement with Hezbollah and Hamas. And the reason I think that's both important is both kind of interesting where Hezbollah and Hamas comes, but how much more even than that in terms of the engagement with North Korea. So that even for Americans who don't think pay much attention to foreign policy, they are distinguishing between, you know, what engagement means. And to step back a little bit for those following polls, the way we do these polls is we reached out to about 1,500 Americans. We're very careful. We work with knowledge networks about sampling and providing, it's an internet poll, and so providing internet access to those who don't have it, making sure in terms of age and party and all of that is sampled accordingly. So in terms of this change, Americans are also, as we know, very supportive of signing treaties. We've seen that over the last number of years. So in 2006, 70% thought the U.S. should participate in the Kyoto agreements. And this year, when we looked at treaties, in particular Kyoto, there was even greater support, you know, 76%. So not a huge jump, but again, it's that trend line that even more Americans thought that participating in Kyoto or a Kyoto-like agreement was important, and it was framed in reference to Copenhagen and relooking at climate in 2010. There was a view, and you know, this isn't an issue that's going to come up again, but those who are watching Japan and trying to figure out where Americans are, a question asking about, you know, if there was other countries who would be added as perm rets at the United Nations. 67% and 60 6% thought that Japan and Germany in that order should be added, whereas 47% thought South Africa and 53% thought India. But there was bipartisan support, very bipartisan support, in the Japan finding, which again is a suggestion about how Americans view Japan that Mike will talk about. What I think this change suggests is that there is a real role for important partners and allies to play in the years to come. The numbers to me suggest that there's an opportunity for new sets of policies, new sets of actors, re-engagement with other actors, and that certainly it's not a blank slate. Of course, no administration starts with a blank slate, but there is enormous support to move in different directions if a new president and administration chooses to. The one area that I think is very important, and especially important for Japan and Japanese experts to think about, is how Americans are feeling domestically, especially in light of the financial crisis. With such a powerful economy, Japan can't help but think about how Americans are viewing issues of globalization. And for a powerful economy in the U.S., we should all be interested in how Americans are viewed with globalizations. And what we did find, probably not surprisingly, is that there's growing concern that the support for globalization that is still there is eroding. So a majority of Americans still do believe globalization is mostly good for the United States, and we define globalization as the linking of our economy to others around the world. But if you look at the number of Americans who think it's mostly bad, that is rising. So in 2004, 31% of Americans thought globalization was mostly bad. In 2006, it was 35%. In 2008, July, when the data was taken, it's 39%. And then when we repolled on some questions in September in light of the crisis that was breaking in the financial markets, 42% thought that it was mostly bad. So we see a steady increase in Americans. And in Chicago, you know, in the heart of the Midwest, we certainly feel that. And what I put out as a suggestion is that we can't take for granted American support for globalization. There's still a majority believes it's important, but we can't take it for granted. And for those of us who advocate international engagement, these are disturbing trends and worrisome signals and signs. And I think it puts out for the suggestion that our partners and allies can play a very important role in making the case for global engagement, because Americans are feeling a bit gun-shy because of the state of the economy, and especially in parts of the Midwest, the old industrial Midwest, where the home of isolationism, where that is rising. And I think that should be of concern. But going back to what I was saying earlier, there is an opportunity and a kind of willingness to reach out and engage with friends and allies, and an important role that they can play in helping to echo back the argument that even in these difficult times, that global engagement is important and something that we mutually seek. So with that, let me turn it over to the actual numbers on Japan.
Thanks, Rachel. When Rachel and Marshall asked me to help design a poll on what Americans think of Japan, I immediately thought of this joke that some of you have heard that was going around when I was in grad school about the three authors who were asked to write a book about elephants. I've used this joke in this room before. Apologies. An American, a Frenchman, and a Japanese are each asked to write a book about elephants, and the American's book comes out a year later, and the title is How to Make Money on Elephants with No Interest and No Money Down. And the Frenchman's book is called How Elephants Make Love. And then the Japanese author comes back, and his book is called What Elephants Think About Japan. I didn't think that would be a good title for the report, though, so I saved it for this occasion. We added basically 15 questions specifically on Japan and mixed them in the poll on overall U.S. views of the world so as not to sort of skew the attitudes about Japan, and came up with some, we thought, in terms of U.S.-Japan relations, quite encouraging results, and results that showed, we thought, some real nuance and sophistication to the average American's view of Asia, of our alliances, of the triangular U.S.-Japan-China relationship. When you go through the numbers, there's some subtlety and nuance to thinking about power and relations in the region that was interesting and encouraging. Rather than seeing the rise of China as making Japan less important, what we found is that Americans see Japan as becoming more important precisely because of China. and that Japan has influence and continues to have influence in the views of most Americans. There's a high expectation of Japan on the security side, which could lead to something of an expectations gap in terms of what Japan can deliver on international security, maybe a challenge for Prime Minister Aso for the next American president. There's a very high level of comfort with Japan on the economic side. It's almost a reverse of the 1980s or early 1990s, which suggests that the U.S. and Japan are comfortable with each other enough, or at least Americans are comfortable enough with Japan, that Japan should really have quite an influential voice on our overall approach to global economic issues. So to go through the numbers a bit, the first chart, which you'll see on page 2, on the importance of countries to the United States, shows that 45% of Americans thought Japan is very important. Now, that ranks Japan fourth behind Great Britain, Canada, and China. Now, some people may have had the reaction, Japan is now ranking behind China. That's sort of the glass half empty view of things. The glass half full view would be Japan is ranked ahead of very important allies of the United States like Israel, very important players in the international system like Saudi Arabia, allies like Germany, way ahead of France. So it's mixed, but I would add a few caveats that we also found in the numbers in terms of Japan's standing with the American public. First, as I said, while Japan ranks fourth, it ranks significantly above other important American allies like Israel and Germany. Second, this graph shows you how important Americans think Japan is. It doesn't show you how much Americans like Japan or how much they trust Japan. China is more important than Japan in the views of the American public, but not necessarily in a good way. And you find that when you look at the polls that the Chicago Council did, asking for a barometer of how warmly Americans feel towards various countries, with 100 being very warm and 0 being very, very cold or negative, and 50 being neutral. Japan ranked with 59 on a scale of 0 to 100 compared to China, which ranked 41. So Americans clearly, while they would argue at the margins China is more important, feel much more warmly towards Japan. That's the second caveat I would add. The other thing is that as Americans look at Asia, overall, they see Japan as an influential player in the system, even though they recognize that Japan's relative economic power is declining. Interestingly, in this survey, one of the questions is how influential a country is on a scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being most influential. And Japan's score actually went up since the 2006 poll, from 6.4 to 7.5, so a whole percentage point higher in terms of how influential Japan is seen in the system by the United States. China went up a little bit more than Japan, from 6.4 to 7.9%. Now, Rachel will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is in the context of two important things. One is Americans seeing the rest of the world overall being more important. So everybody's score went up a little bit. But Asia's score went up significantly compared to Europe, and you see that in Figure 3. And this has been a secular trend since essentially the late 1990s, where Americans have increasingly recognized the importance of Asia relative to Europe. In terms of the nature of Japanese influence, on page 4, you'll see in figure 4 that the main source in the minds of Americans, the main sources of Japanese influence is technology and innovation. 65% of Americans said that was very important to Japan's overall influence. And if you think about what Americans see of Japan, Prius, Lexus, and so on and so forth, it makes some sense that the view of Japan would be very positive in terms of technology. Economic power ranked second with 49%. Leadership in Asia with 39%. Japan's democracy, 36%. Economic assistance to other countries, 31%. Japan's military strength, in terms of Japanese influence, ranked fairly low at only 17%. Americans thought that 17% of Americans thought Japan's military role was very important to Japan's influence. Now, at this point, it might be tempting, and my first reaction was to think the American public doesn't really expect Japan to do much on the security side. They expect Japan to do a lot in terms of technology or those areas. But when we looked at other numbers, we found that this 17% shows what Americans think is the current source of Japanese influence. 17% of Americans think that military power or military roles is very important to Japan's current influence. But when you start looking at later numbers, you find that the American public has a much higher expectation for what Japan should be doing in terms of its security role to maintain its influence and to be a strong partner and play a role in a greater role in the world. And that gets back to this question in part about China and the rise of China, because you begin to see a correlation between how the public views Japan's role and how it views how we should deal with China. We asked about how America should approach China, the overall strategy was quite sophisticated and nuanced and multidimensional. 64% of Americans said they prefer to undertake friendly cooperation and engagement with China rather than attempt to limit the growth of Chinese power. Only 33% said we should try to limit the growth of Chinese power. So very strong support for engagement of China. And I think you see that in this presidential election. There's relatively, I would argue, significantly less China bashing than we saw, for example, Japan bashing in the 1988 or 1992 elections. And a lot less China bashing than I think a lot of China experts expected, given the rising power of China and the economic situation in the U.S., but 64% of Americans support engagement. But interestingly, when we asked, and only 33% said try to limit Chinese power, but when the poll asked, should the United States and Japan work together to limit the rise of Chinese power in the years ahead, when you put it in terms of the U.S. and Japan working together, a majority, 54%, said yes. Doing it with Japan, we should work in the future to limit Chinese power. And this, I think, paints a view of Asia, a majority view in the American public, of positive engagement of China, but hedging against China's future with closer alliance relations with Japan. And in many ways, I would say that characterizes both McCain and Obama's foreign policy strategy in Asia in many ways. Americans do appear ready to let China, to let Japan increase its military capabilities based on China's rising power. 66% of the public, American public polled, 66% said that Japan needs to be freer to project military power because of China's growing power. And the public was not oblivious to the possible reaction from China. I was struck that 49% said that they recognized that a larger Japanese military role could create what international relations experts call a security dilemma or a backlash from China or tension. They recognize that, but 66% argued Japan should be, compared to today, freer to do more with their military because of the rise of China. When we asked about the revision of Article 9 of the Constitution, 57%, a majority of Americans, said Japan should revise the Constitution and Article 9 to allow more role of the military. And in this polling question, we obviously had a brief description of Article 9 to provide the context so people knew what they were saying. That's, I believe, higher than most polls, any polls in Japan about constitutional revision, about Article 9 of the Constitution. So, you know, on balance, Americans want to see Japan's constitution changed more than Japanese do. But that 57% number is lower than the numbers in terms of what Americans want Japan to do. So when asked, do you want Japan to do more in peacekeeping, 84% of Americans said yes. When asked, do you want Japan to participate in international combat missions in places like Iraq, 67% said yes. When asked whether Japan should have independent military missions, not just coalition, but independent military missions, 69% said yes. So the American public is at least comfortable and perhaps even, you know, eager to see Japan do more with its defense forces. But I found the 57% on constitutional revision suggested that the public is respectful of Japan's process and in many ways, I think, open to, you know, a Japanese definition of what the security role would be. To me, the fact that 80%, 67%, that significantly higher numbers said Japan should do more in these security areas, whereas only 50%, a majority, but a much lower majority, said change the Constitution, suggests that in many ways the ball is in Japan's court to decide how, in the views of the American public, to decide how this is done. The higher numbers in terms of Japan's roles in peacekeeping and coalition operations than what you'd see in Japan. Because if you know, we looked at comparable polls on these kinds of things in Japan, and the Japanese public's readiness to do this is much lower, it creates what we call an expectations gap. It may or may not be a problem for the next president and for Prime Minister Aso. But in terms of public expectations, the polls show quite clearly a gap. One area where there's no gap is on the question of nuclear weapons, where large majorities of Americans and Japanese say Japan should not have nuclear weapons. Actually, the number of Americans who said Japan should not have nuclear weapons is a little bit lower than the number of Japanese who say Japan should have not have nuclear weapons in Asahi Shimbun's most recent poll. So our Japanese friends get this even better. And the reasons why Japan shouldn't have nuclear weapons are described in Figure 6 on page 6 and are what you'd largely expect. On the bases question, also I thought an interesting convergence of Japanese and American public views. And these are described on page 6. And basically 58% of Americans think the United States should have long-term bases in Japan. And that's comparable, by the way, to what Americans think about Germany and Korea and Iraq, interestingly. But 55% said there are too many U.S. troops in Japan. So the sweet spot, the combination of those two, is an American view that we've got to have bases in Japan for the long run. It's important, but we've got to look at ways to reduce our footprint, if you will. And I think that is very much consistent with where the Japanese public is. So on the base issue, although the devil's in the details, and as Izuka-san knows well from working for Yomiuri in Okinawa, those details, and as Russ Deming knows, those details can kill you. As an overall concept, I think the American and Japanese public are generally in the same place about what our base structure should look like in Japan, and that's, I think, a healthy thing. The economic news is very good, which is, of course, a mirror image of what this poll might have shown 15 or 20 years ago. 59% of Americans support an FTA with Japan. That is almost 10 points higher than the 49% of Americans who favor generically the idea of free trade agreements. So on balance, Americans, a plurality of Americans oppose free trade agreements. But when it comes to Japan, 59% support. It's interesting. You would never have had this figure 10 or 15 years ago. So the high level of comfort with Japan on trade compared with other countries and compared with the past. You'll see on page 7, in figure 7, on the question of unfair trade practices, how high Japan was. 65% thought Japan engaged in unfair trade, as you'll see, in the 1990s, early 1990s. And you can see how quickly that number has dropped, so that only 25 to 28% in the past 4 years think Japan engages in unfair trade practices. And, of course, Japan's position as the unfair trader has been now taken by China. As you can see in the poll on China, the polling figures began in 2002, and now it's the Chinese side who Americans think are unfair. So Rachel had an interesting point earlier about Americans' declining support for globalization. And this poll on U.S.-Japan trade and economic relations really stands in contrast to that. At a time when Americans are suspicious of trade, where support for globalization is declining, Americans are increasingly comfortable with our economic relationship with Japan. To me, as a policy matter, or as an agenda item, that really is a strong case for a U.S.-Japan economic partnership of some kind. Whether an FTA is right, or an economic partnership agreement, or an enhanced sub-cabinet, some kind of U.S.-Japan strategic dialogue on economic relations and agenda setting together, I think will be potentially quite helpful in our own political context. In terms of the overall view of Japan vis-a-vis China, as I said, I was struck at the nuance, the engaging, hedging strategy the American public understood, the importance of Japan precisely because of China's growing influence and uncertainty about China's future. And precisely because I think the American public gets that, I think that there will be broad support for the next president to engage in a strategic dialogue with Japan on how we engage China, how we shape China's future. I think the American public expects, and you should expect this in the Congress and others, I would think, from these polls, that the U.S. and Japan are going to work on this China issue together, but it's going to be a combination of engagement, hedging, shaping, but very strong public support for a U.S.-Japan alliance as we look at a China that both publics are ready to engage but have questions about, and see the value of our alliance together as we shape China's position into the future. There you have it. The challenge is there in terms of the expectation gap, but also an enormous opportunity in terms of our work together on China and on trade. And I think, on the whole, a ringing endorsement from the American public for the U.S.-Japan alliance at a time when some of our Japanese friends worry that we're about to go through another period of Japan passing. Ranking fourth is not that bad. As Rachel, you didn't mention the city poll, but the Chicago Council also did a survey of globalized cities, which cities are the most viewed as the most globalized in the world. And Tokyo came in fourth on that one, too, and I'd say that isn't so bad either. So a good public sentiment about Japan at a time when a new president will come in, and both candidates, I think, have positive views of the U.S.-Japan alliance, and this should be encouragement for those in the two camps who want to do more on Japan. Thank you. Izuka-san.
Thank you for having me to discuss this interesting and important results of the survey. Nowadays, it seems to me that people's attention here in Washington, D.C. are more intensely paid to China. So I really appreciate the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and Dr. Mike Green for remaining dedicated to Japan and holding this kind of session. And I presume that my attitude like this, like a sulky, jealous girl who starts crabbing at her boyfriend, not calling me as often as he used to, might be one of the subjects of today's discussion. My first honest reaction to reading this survey is that, Japan is finally behind China in terms of importance to the American public. 45% versus 52%. Well, no matter how much John McCain or Joseph Nye or Mike Green tried to soothe my pessimism, this is somewhat a shock for most Japanese who have been taught and believe themselves as the most important partner of the America in the Asia-Pacific. So, but I believe that Japan has to become more mature and behave like an adult lady who appreciates the high expectations from the important ally. And so I try to calm myself and analyze with a cool head. And I would like to look at the survey from three perspectives. Number one, Japan as an influential player. And number two, Japan as a hedge against China. And number three, Japan as an economic player. And first, Japan's influence, that's mainly described on page four. Let aside the importance issue, I think the question and the perception of whether Japan is an influential player in the international community is a very important one. Based on the survey, Japan's influence is most prominent in the area of technology and innovation, like Mike pointed out. And I appreciate that this has been consistent for years, perhaps thanks to Sony, Toyota, Honda, and those companies and scientists' achievements. But I believe that Japan's influence on contribution in the fields of democratic system and economic assistance to other countries should be evaluated more positively. Of course, people who closely watch Japan are aware that it is no longer the number one contributor of the foreign assistance, or ODA, as it used to be during the 1990s. According to the OECD's research released this April, Japan has fallen from third to fifth place in 2007, overtaken by France and Germany, with the top two being the US and the UK. But still, Japan has contributed significantly, especially in recent days, to Southeast Asian countries and more developing countries in Asia, providing some basis for political stability and democracy. We all have learned that poverty is one of the primary sources of the idea of extremism and or terrorism. So I think this long-standing contribution should not be overlooked And I also think that Japanese government should be much savvier and more tactful in appealing these strengths. We could go into the discussion of military strength later if the floor is interested, but I will move on to the second hedge issue now. Both Rachel and Mike pointed out, I found this analysis of hedging on page 4 quite interesting. While 64 of Americans prefer to undertake friendly cooperation and engagement with China, like Mike pointed out, 54 believes that U.S. and Japan should work together to limit the rise of Chinese power in the years ahead. As the survey properly points out, I think that the American people seem to understand the complex mix of cooperation and competition. In U.S.-China relations, with the awareness of Japan's presence nearby, it is very important to think about the trilateral relations within the area. It makes me think that this is one of the fundamental agenda for the new U.S. administration to formulate a foreign policy that involves the element of triangular relations. To be frank, having looked at the long campaign of this presidential election, I feel somewhat relieved as a Japanese citizen to hear when Mr. McCain makes his speech stressing the conventional bilateral alliance first policy. On the other hand, Mr. Obama shows the attitude to think more transnationally with a view to strengthen a strategic tie with China and puts the more importance on multilateral frameworks such as six-party talks. The notion of alliance seems somewhat submerged in other multilateral frameworks. So the result of the survey is quite insightful. How would the new president utilize the framework of the Japan-U.S. bilateral alliance in order to maximize the fruit of the relationship with China, both in cooperation and competition? This is, I think, a fundamental question that starts from January. I think that Tokyo has a lot to do when the new U.S. administration launches in incorporating ideas and also appealing what Tokyo could do and hope to do with Washington, what that might create, what that might fill the expectation gap, which Mike has just pointed out. And in relation to this, I will move on to economic cooperation. That's my final point. Economic cooperation between Japan and the U.S. is described on page 6. The survey finds that there is wide support for expanding economic relations between the U.S. and Japan, including the free trade agreement. I think that this view is quite important and welcoming result for today's Japan, given the situation of this global financial crisis, where Tokyo is now struggling to show its presence as a rather stable economic power, as it had showed more than 20 years ago. Today and yesterday's newspaper in Tokyo all at once announced that the postponement of the lower house election that many had expected on November 30th. Against all the speculations, the current Prime Minister Aso has shown no sign of holding the election this next month, insisting that now is the time to prioritize, to think seriously about the measures to stem the crisis. Of course, Japanese economy has been hit seriously in the crisis. Japan is now going through yen's ferocious upsurge and the steep decline of the stock market. But still, Japan is somehow feeling a sense of reward compared to the U.S. and a country like Iceland for largely avoiding the recent credit bubble. It had strived to overcome the damages of the previous bubble burst that had started nearly 20 years ago. So Prime Minister Aso now thinks that as a country which is relatively less damaged by the current crisis so far, this is Japan's opportunity to talk about the lesson from the past damage and could initiate some measures in cooperation with the U.S. and other major economic players. for him, attending the summit meeting of G20 on 15th of November in Washington and other international meetings related to this crisis would cost him a chance to restore the image of Japan's reputation as a reliable economic power. I think that it is quite a good idea being here observing Nagata-cho as an outsider. By the way, I am now ignoring all the dissonance within the ruling coalitions, much less the opposition parties, which strongly demanded to call for general election as early as possible. But I think the result should be covered by many Japanese media and U.S. media as well, that Japan is going to be a very reliable partner as an economic and maybe the security partner. In conclusion, I think the study by the Chicago Council casts us a lot of insights for the future of the Japan-U.S. relationship. The policies start from awareness, so I think the survey contributes greatly from this perspective. That's my observation.
Thank you, Keiko. That's very helpful. I'd like to open it up for questions for me, if you'd like, on how we came to this, some of these conclusions, for Rachel about methodology or past findings, for Izuka-san, with people like David Hitchcock who've been doing this kind of polling and analyzing these for, I won't say how long, a couple years. but I want to first ask Keiko a question, because I was struck by something you said. You said that the graph on page 4, figure 4, factors in Japan's influence, that you were... I think you said disappointed that Japan's democratic system and economic assistance did not get more credit among Americans, which now that you mention it, I wish we had put in this report because it's a good point. Maybe that is a quite a newsworthy aspect of this. What would you do to fix that? What do you think Japan can do on either democracy, Japan's democratic system, or on ODA that Japan needs to do? To get those numbers up.
Yes, actually, this is a headache for the current leaders in Japanese government because the ODA, the foreign assistance, the amount of the money is, well, actually declining in these, well, after Koizumi administration. So Japan cannot be too proud to announce or appeal to the world that Japan is doing the best to help out the developing countries. But still, this long-standing contribution, maybe Japan has strived after the war by helping out. Even itself is still building up, trying to build up, rebuild its country from the scratch of the war, it has been trying to help out the developing countries such as China and South Korea and Southeast Asia. So, and we believe that that have helped to stabilize those developing countries. So, and to the world peace, so eventually. So I think that the image of Japan helping out other countries in terms of economic assistance is so low. It was not what I expected.
This figure 4 shows what people think are a source of influence. I think having a new prime minister every year and frequent elections reminds people that you have a democratic system. But there may be ways for Japan to highlight its role as a democracy and what it can contribute as a democracy in ODA.
Right. Sorry. And come back to your question. I think that Japan should appeal more to the international community. It's tried to, as you know, that at the United Nations, it's tried to hold a permanent seat at the UN Security Council because Japan argues that it pays much more burden for the security UN United Nations management. So in that kind of argument, I think Japan should put proudly forward more actively, I think.
Can I actually just to jump in on this and to round it out a little bit, one of the things that was so very interesting is when the question was asked for Americans about what foreign policy goals should be, and securing stable sources of energy so high, and even higher when it was taken in July for obvious reasons, oil prices at $150. Promoting democracy was very low in terms of what Americans thought should be a key foreign policy goal. And I put that out in this context as we can kind of hypothesize why that might be. We just have the number, but in part because of an administration that was so vocally promoting it in such a military fashion that that Americans have sort of grew distasteful of it, in addition to which it hadn't always been as high it got pushed forward. But I think there's also a potential third one, and one worth digging into, is this increasing sense of, in part because of how we pursued the last few years, that we're very much going it alone. And if you look at the support for multilateral institutions for working with the UN, that the Americans were basically, that when polled, are kind of signaling to the administration that they don't think it should be high, and very possibly also that we shouldn't be doing this alone. And it's interesting to me that you're disappointed by where, you know, the Americans think about the importance of democratization with Japan, that, again, there may be an opportunity of thinking about the Americans kind of growing distaste for this unilateral promotion of democratization, and your concern that Japan's democratic system isn't getting the attention it should of, again, another area that may suggest opportunities for cooperation or collaboration as we look forward into what do you want to put on the agenda of U.S.-Japanese relations.
Right. I like the way you put that. And we did mention in the report that we tried to highlight that as an agenda item you'll find. In particular, the advantage to the U.S. of work to enhance our shared values and democratic norms being done with countries like Japan in the lead and not us necessarily. Let me open the floor up for questions, criticism, comments. Start with Rusty.
You can't see over here. So, yeah.
As I read this on the methodology, you're trying to, the 1,500 survey to trying to replicate the U.S. population essentially based on demography and education, et cetera. If that's the case, then this represents a rather uninformed response because Japan is so far below the radar for most Americans. There's so little real information out there that the answers are really sort of collective hunches about, you know, what the right thing to do is. And since Japan policy is likely to be decided by leadership groups, wouldn't it have been more meaningful to survey meet leadership groups who are really going to make the decisions about these issues, given the lack of great public involvement in Japan policy for the last 10 years, perhaps? Second, it seems to me that one question missing here was Japan as a partner on global challenges like the environment and like energy conservation, renewable energy and other alternative energy sources, where it seems to me, particularly if Obama's elected, that's the real strength, there are real opportunities there for U.S.-Japan collaboration. Because of Japan's high technology, it would have been interesting to ask a question of where that, in the public perception, is that seen as something that would be of interest to the American public. Thanks.
Just on the first question, and Mike, I don't know if you want to pick up on the second, but on the first of looking at the elite versus public, I think you're absolutely right that it should be a focus on elites if you're trying to anticipate what the policy will or should be. What we're trying to capture is a more of where the public support is, that what kind of winds does a new administration have to sail with, and what would possibly be a stop in that. And so that's the focus on the public is you're absolutely right. It does reflect a sense of hunches. What always strikes me of looking at this data, though, is a level of sophistication from the American public. Across, you know, we tend to say it's uninformed, and perhaps it is, but where they're coming from doesn't deviate that much from the conversations that I think are transpiring in this and similar rooms. And so it was less about anticipating where it should go, but you know, where there's opportunities and where there's support for moving forward.
I think that's right, and we are doing a survey of elites, too. the CSIS is, across Asia on the role of alliances on issues and so on and so forth. And we'll have that in December. So stay tuned if you want to. And it'll be interesting. We don't have exactly the same questions, but it'll give a sense of some sense of where elites. And these surveys, it's always hard to define elites. In the survey that we're now conducting in 10 countries in Asia, including the U.S., we went for what we call the strategic elite, so not the business elite necessarily, but think tank scholars and so forth. So we'll see. We'll have that to look at as well. But I would agree with Rachel. I think this result shows a certain amount of it's more than a hunch. There's more logic connecting these different answers than you would get if you got somebody just sort of wildly making stuff up. On the global challenges, I agree with you in terms of global challenges being an agenda item. You know, we did this all-day conference on Thursday with Vice Minister Yachi and others here to start trying to frame up what a global agenda would be on climate change and energy and development assistance. And I think you see some evidence in these poll numbers that there would be support for that. For example, the answers on the economic side, some of the high influence given to Japan on technology. One of the reasons that we emphasize this balance of power stuff is in part because this was an adjunct to a larger survey that the Chicago Council did, which asked a lot of questions about the rise of China. So some of the interesting insights we found were when we asked questions about Japan that sort of resonated with larger American perceptions of China, and those for this survey jumped out at us. I suspect that if you did broad surveys on cooperation with Japan on global challenges, you'd get very positive responses. We could probably test that in a poll in the future. But I think your hunch about this is right, that there would be support for it. This expectations gap on the security side, I think, is a bit more of a challenge that will have to be managed, because as much as Barack Obama or John McCain emphasize climate change cooperation, development assistance, and so forth with Japan, which they absolutely should, the real pressures are going to keep coming on Afghanistan and so on, and those are the ones that will be in the headlines more. So I think that piece, I think, is going to, points to something the next administration will have to think about how to manage.
Yeah, I had a comment, really, perhaps that you could comment on it, on figure 5. And I think what I was troubled by, really, is the impression the results give that Japan, that the U.S. would favor independent combat missions by Japan. Now, I understand it says international law, but at the very end of that, more than it would favor participation in international combat missions. I think you've loaded that question by putting Iraq in there. What if you substituted Bosnia or Kosovo? Would that have stayed lower than independent combat missions? Is there any history involved in the respondents to Japan's international combat missions of the past? I'm just not very happy with those two questions in the way they're phrased.
The original questions.
Thank you.
I can go back and find it. I actually I don't have the overtime, but if I get your card on the way out, I'll make sure to get it for you.
The way we wrote this is actually a bit confusing, I'm seeing now. The question on Iraq was on coalition operations in places like Iraq and then independent combat missions.
It's international, that's what, it may not be legal. UN is not. International, the participation in Iraq mm-hmm. is. What do you mean by international?
Well,
multinational.
The point you make about Iraq, I think, is a good one that we thought about, because Iraq is loaded, but that's an experience Japan has, and the question is, should Japan go on to the next step in a case like Iraq? That's why we put Iraq in. And that may have given a more negative response. Yeah.
Yes, Dave Fitzgerald, private consultant. I'd like to go back to figure one, and I was struck by Izuka-san's mention of that. I think a lot of Japanese would jump on that as to why, you know, the rankings of China versus Japan. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what went into the ranking of importance. I mean, I look at this and I see, well, Britain and Canada, I think most Americans can figure out where those places are and have some idea of that without really much thought at all. But how do they sort of arrive at responding to this question as to what's important?
So they're asked independently on these countries. So the question that the surveyor asks, or that they're receiving as on it, is so on Great Britain, do you think it's very important, somewhat important, not important? And you rank each question, and then you tally up. So how many thought Britain was very important, and so they're independent, but then we put them together to see the very importance. How do they stack up next to each other? Right, and that's where the thermometer becomes so important that Mike was talking about. There can be in Saudi Arabia, right, is where it is because of its strategic, you know, resources. Whereas, you know, Great Britain shared history and this and that. You know, you can kind of load it up, but it's then the thermometer that becomes the important one to figure out. Well, is it because you, you know, as Mike was rightfully talking about, how you feel about that country and willingness to engage and participate and, you know, the whole set of activities that could go up around it. So, again, coming back to Saudi Arabia, 44%. On the plane down, I was looking at the thermometers, and it's 40% of – it was 30% of Americans ranked it between 0 and 30, you know, on a scale of – with 100 being the hottest and the warmest. It was a huge number, and then add to who feel, you know, very cold towards Japan. Towards Saudi Arabia, add those then in the 31 to 49%. It was 42%. So even though it ranks fifth, it would rank very high in terms of low feelings towards that country.
Yeah. My question overlaps some with Russ, methodological question. I guess Sam Shepard with NAGIS. Was there any effort to tease out their knowledge about the various countries, like Japan? In other words, you know, was there any effort to find out whether, when the Japanese Constitution was mentioned, whether they knew anything about the Constitution?
No. This was just a sample of Americans, and so there wasn't those questions on that. Some of it, you know, obviously you start thinking about how you put the questions together. That obviously becomes important as you're informing them as you go along. And so that's why we worded some of the questions as you know, or we would put in some background to the question. But the people being asked, it was a random sample of Americans.
When I was first brought into this, my first thought was, I'd like to ask questions on which Japanese you think are most important, for example, you know, on what you know about Japan. Those were the kinds of things I was curious about as a Japan guy. But this survey was done, I quickly learned, this was a piece of a larger survey which has a long history, which is asking Americans about their role in the world and questions about who you can rely on, who you can rely on, what's important, what's not important, and that kind of stuff. So we, you know, designed the questions to fit into that set. And if we had had a series of questions saying, you know, which of the following four Japanese do you know, or the things I'm sort of curious to see if Americans know, it would have been really out of place. So there's something for NAGIS to do in future, the how much do you know about Japan poll. And precisely because we didn't do that, we did, as Rachel said, have to have short sort of, you know, as you know, or the Japanese Constitution, Article 9 says, pop, 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 pop.
Don? The one question that strikes me as not very good is in Figure 5, support for expanded military role, where you say independent combat missions just like any other country. When you say just like any other country, that's kind of telling people you should approve it. If you take out the just like any other country, I think you get a more straightforward report of what people think about it.
They went back and forth on this question on that in terms of if you left it out versus putting it in, and there was a long conversation back and forth on it. it was trying to go back and tease out the issue that this is something new, that this would be a change. And it was part of an effort to provide some context and education. And the concern was in leaving it out that people wouldn't realize that in answering, yes, we think they should participate, that there was that was at all an issue. And so it was trying to highlight that. But you may very well be right, which is that then affects the way people answer it. But it was part of going back to that challenge of how do you provide some context and education as you go along so people have a framing for what they're answering. But then the negative side is you may lead them then in a direction.
It's if this were the fourth, you know, district of Ohio and we were counting hanging chads, we'd worry about it more. And we did go back and forth, and we were trying to capture three things: multinational coalition operations in a place like Iraq, in the way that Australia or Korea or others participate, independent, you know, so quote-unquote normal military missions, and then peacekeeping. You know, the margin of error for these questions is probably fairly large, but the thing that's striking is how significant the majorities are that Japan and that the self-defense forces, the American public, expects them to do more. And it's consistent, I think, with the larger results in the survey on American views of the world, that we need more help from other countries and the full range of statecraft, from diplomacy to engagement to military.
And the support from the American people that they're will that, again, and this isn't a change. We've shown this, you know, year after year, but that they're willing to then operate within they support working within multilateral organizations, and they will give things up to get that. It's not all of a take and not give. There is a sense from the polls in general, and again, it's a generality, but that a recognition that we need help and that we can do more and we can operate in a way where we would also be more supportive, I think.
Well, for Japanese, just like any other country in terms of combat missions, sounds really a political meaning, significance. So I think it sounded for me that it was quite a reasonable way to put this question, because being a normal country should, I think all of you know that, but it has been a very, very significant question for Japan in terms of military activities overseas by the limitation of the grade to which Japan's involvement is quite limited by the provision of constitution. So for Japanese, as a Japanese, I didn't think it was such a great, I didn't feel any difficulty in understanding this question. But perhaps for most Americans who don't know much about our constitutional issues might take this as a kind a little awkward question.
And in terms of the consistent with international law, part of the back and forth, the concern was that if we didn't put that in, then independent becomes means something different. It means rogue. It means taking action without consulting anything. So
unilateral.
that would skew the responses differently. So it's the independent, but consistent with international law.
Thank you. Mike Miyazawa. I was alarmed by the remark made by Izuka-san. On looking at figure 4, you said Japanese economic assistance deserves more attention, more appreciation. And I think that remark is in line with what Japan's Gaimusho always says. But what you think, what you prefer, what you like is one thing, and what they want you to do is something quite different. And the discussions in Japan very often fail to make a distinction between what you are ready and willing to do, and what they want you to do. So, do you have any comment to make on this point?
Yes, that is an interesting question. I think that, the linking with democratic system and economic assistance to other countries is sometimes dangerous, because we've seen that Bush administration unilaterally waged war by the name, under the name of democratize other countries. So since Japan has a legacy of war, not in terms under the name of democratize a country, but if Japan goes today and telling other Asian countries to let's do democratization, so that we assist more with our foreign assistance, that would create and cause a lot of opposition from developing countries, I think. This sense of democracy and democratization linked with foreign assistance is not, ideal or wise idea to do so. And back to your question, the ODA or foreign assistance, the ways how to utilize those money is, of course, in Japan, there is a lot of discussion, because if you just give them money or just tell them what to do, and if they don't follow, they will not. Japan will not give money. It's a lot of still the Japan is in, I think, in search of what is the best to give money. Let's say the governance or. Yes, the governance is the most important thing. So I think it's a good question, I'm not trying to advocate that what MOFA is doing is very good, but Japan has using our taxpayers' money, trying to help out those developing countries should not be overlooked. I still think that way.
Parameswaran from Agence France-Presse. Could the panel please address some of the challenges facing the new administration against the backdrop of the survey and in trying to basically play a good juggling act, for example, in terms of striking a happy balance between maintaining Japan as a strategic military ally and also having China as a strategic partner?
Well, we thought we saw in the range of answers in this survey an understanding by the 1,500 people who answered this across America that we have to have a policy of engaging China, of expanding cooperation. That's essentially what President Bush, President Clinton before him, and both candidates now have argued for, and there appears to be support for that. But also a recognition that there's a long-term need to hedge. And I think that's a very healthy thing in terms of public opinion, and I think it helps explain in part why there hasn't been the kind of China bashing in this election that some people expected, because the American public largely gets it, the complicated, multifaceted aspect of our engagement and cooperation and competition with China, and they get that Japan is an important piece of how we do that. Now, for the next administration, that will come down to some tough specific calls, because the American public also seems to recognize that while they want Japan to do more, there's always a danger of a security dilemma, that if we do too much, we'll create a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of China becoming an adversary. And people seem to get that. And that means, I think, to answer your question specifically, although we didn't ask about these issues, there's some questions the next administration will have to deal with. For example, what do we do about arms sales to Japan and Taiwan? The Japanese government has been very interested in F-22, which is a fifth-generation fighter more capable than anything the PLA Air Force has. The Bush administration has basically said don't ask for a variety of reasons, not all about China. A lot of it's bureaucratic, technical, budgetary. But there's keen interest in the defense ministry and the JASDAF and the prime minister's office in getting this aircraft because China's tactical air force is, in terms of fourth generation fighters, you know, up towards 300 or 400 now. So the delta, the gap is rapidly growing. So do you try to maintain that balance of forces? But by doing so, you risk that security dilemma with China. That's the kind of tough call the next administration will have. Same thing with F-16s with Taiwan, for example. You know, how far do we go with missile defense? How do we structure our diplomacy on issues like North Korea? Do we emphasize the trilateral coordination group with Japan and Korea, even if it slows down the process somewhat to make sure our allies are on board? Or do we do what I think we've been doing more recently, which is sort of do that in parallel or after the fact so we can get movement? I mean, those are the kind of almost tactical decisions which the next administration will have to make and Japan will have to make that will decide how you strike this balance. But what this poll shows is the American people realize you need the balance, which I think is a good thing. I mean, you don't have people saying, get China, get China. You don't have people saying, we can trust China. It's a pretty healthy balance.
Yamakoshi of Keidan, the USA. Personally, I think this result are not so much shocking to me. Just kind of moderate impression to me, because this research is a little bit general. So even though we are behind China on the first tier, but as I already pointed out, important for what reason is more important than, you know, the just recognition of importance. And in addition to that general impression, I would like to ask one question about the influence of Japan, and is there any element, pop culture, and you know, sushi, and these things in this questionnaire?
About pop culture, I'm glad you asked that question, because the Chicago Council on Global Affairs did a survey they released in June, which I did not design, but found absolutely fascinating, which asks about soft power in Asia. And we have copies outside, in fact, I think. We have copies of that survey and also the overall survey of American views of global affairs. But what the soft power survey did was look at five countries, U.S., Japan, Korea, Indonesia, and China, and ask about the influence of these countries in terms of diplomatic, cultural, economic, and other sources of influence. And what the survey showed was, across these five countries in Asia, the U.S. is number one in terms of how influence is ranked, and Japan is number two. And I think on culture, Rachel, maybe you could take a look. They're outside. But in culture, Japan did quite well in Asia, and so did Korea. My favorite part of the poll was, one question was, how effective are the other countries, the other four countries, at representing their interests? And every country rated the U.S. number one. Now, the American public rated us number one. I suspect the American elite would have said, no, we stink. We're the worst. I mean, we have no soft power. We have no smart power. I read the CSIS report. We're terrible. But the American public thinks we do pretty well. But the interesting thing was, so did the Japanese, Korean, and Indonesian publics. They thought we were the best at representing our interests. The only country that thought otherwise was China, where the public thought the Chinese government did the best representing their interests, because they read in the People's Daily every day how Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi went to some place and told them, blah, 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 blah. So I really commend that study. It's fascinating. It's the first. There's been a lot of studies on soft power and a lot of academic discussions. This is the first really analytical approach that tries to quantify it, and I think it's quite important. Frankly, the most since David Hitchcock's 1984 study here at CSIS on Asian values. This is the first real effort to kind of capture this. I don't know if you want to. I've bragged enough for you.
I can only do our service survey a disservice after that. But in picking up on that, when we went into that poll, it was to quantify expecting China to do a lot better than it did. So our expectations were we were going to confirm the conventional wisdom, which was that China was much more successful than the U.S. And what surprised us was still the power of U.S. soft power. For us, there was the policy recommendation of, you know, this needs a lot of attention because we don't appreciate that we focus on erosion, but not the fact that still it's quite strong. And as Mike said, for this context, the important role of Japan in that as well.
The council telegraphed its expectation of the results of this five-country survey by commissioning my friend David Schambau, a China expert, to write the report. Yeah. And clearly you expected China to come out number one, and you needed an Americanist.
And then just to follow up on something different, but to pick up on what you're saying. So a couple days ago, we released a report that we did with A.T. Kearney and Foreign Policy Magazine, and it's in this issue of Foreign Policy Magazine where we rank cities and how global a city is. And we looked at sixty cities across the globe, and we looked at the in terms of globalization, and we looked at the normal kind of indicators that many look, you know, ease of doing business, transactions, but we also added culture and politics, political engagement, how engaged the city is. So it's different. We looked at established measurements, and we incorporate them, and A.T. Kearney did a great job in running them. But Tokyo came out as number four, with New York was one, followed by London, Paris, and then Tokyo. But it picked up on issues of culture and political engagement, which escalated capitals, obviously, but also made important that a global city needs to attract a global talent pool, and you only do that if it's not only thriving but a comfortable place to live, and that's why we looked at culture. So it's a little different than your question, but in terms of where Tokyo stacked up against its counterparts, it was incredibly high.
And you know, of course, that in Michelin's rating of cities in terms of food, Tokyo is number one. So, and that doesn't include all the little izakaya and sushi restaurants in Akasaka that three LDP politicians know about.
Yeah, Russell. Just one quick question on figure two, feelings toward Japan and China. Where do these feelings stand in comparison with feelings toward other countries? Are these high for Japan, median, or how do they rank?
In terms of one barometer.
You know, we didn't look at it over time. It ranked relatively high in the sense that at 60 is up where, you know, countries that we like were at. So I don't know exactly where, but the reason we ran this over time, we don't usually do it, is because we now knew, in focusing on Japan, of what was going on with China. And the story then was, the story and the numbers of that was, again, not just the kind of absolute, but where it's going in terms of how Americans are thinking about it.
So Japan being the top 10 and China being in the middle somewhere in terms of comparison with other countries?
Yeah. You did the barometer for a lot of countries, right?
I'll pull it out.
It may be in the overall report that's outside. I seem to recall Japan being like in the top four or five.
Yeah. I can pull it out here. If you ask Mike a few more questions, I can.
Yeah, we'll do another question while we look. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Deshimaru. I'm a staff writer of Nikkei. Thank you very much for this survey. And it's very, the results are very impressive. And I'm quite interested in a figure six. And I've been wondering that in what circumstances did you put this question to in the survey? So why now it's about nuclear weapons? And according to this survey, the line four, the 33% said that if Japan build nuclear weapons, it would reduce the burden on the United States of defending it from attack. And how can we read this line?
It does not mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Rachel, it does not mean that 59% of Americans... it does not mean that Americans want Japan to have nuclear weapons. These are the academic pros and cons. The overall results, when asked, were overwhelmingly opposed in the U.S., which is not surprising. It was not surprising, but we put that question in just to test in the wake of the North Korean nuclear test, what American thinking would be. I don't know if you want to.
No, I don't.
Did you find?
Yeah, I am. But so I can come up and show it to you when we're here.
Maybe we have time for one more question. Well, it's been a really very interesting for me to work with the Chicago Council. It's a survey, and it's a public survey, and it does not answer or predict all of the policy issues that we are looking at, but it does give you some sense of the American public's views of Japan. I think they're good on the whole, and should give encouragement to the next administration to come up with a robust agenda with Japan, including global issues, as we discussed Thursday. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Keiko. Thank you all. Brief advertisement. Tomorrow, we're really, you know, Japan Chair's, when it rains, it pours. We're doing a lot this week. Tomorrow, looking for Nick. I'm going to get the times wrong. We have two. Sorry? We don't? Oh, you're saying here I am. Tomorrow, we have two events, which may have been interest, which may be of interest. At 2:30, Richard Koo, the chief economist for Nomura Securities, is going to give a talk. I had dinner with him last night. It will depress and terrify you. I encourage you to come. It basically looks at Japan's lost decade, which he's written a book on. And his argument is that the lost decade was a balance sheet recession, and Japan came out of it with stimulus packages and by addressing its books, not by economic reform. It's a kind of, if you know Takenaka Hezo's argument, it's the anti-Takenaka argument. So he's now got a new book out explaining that that's what the U.S. has to do. Basically 5 years of stimulus packages, slow down the restructuring. It's a bit controversial, but it's very compelling at one level and a little bit depressing. So I think it'll be a very hot debate. I don't know people who are coming from the Peterson Institute and Georgetown economic departments to take him on. That's at 2:30 with Richard Koo, and we'll have copies of his book. Then at 4 o'clock, our own Wakabayashi-san, formerly in the embassy here, formerly Democratic Party of Japan and Rengo, has written a strategy paper on, Rusty, how to build an agenda for U.S.-Japan global cooperation. And he's going to present that paper. And for those of you who are interested, I think we'd appreciate your feedback and attendance. That's right after the Richard Koo thing. It's like graduate school. That's at 4 o'clock. And then the take-home exam will be the week after. So thank you both. Thank you all for coming. And we are adjourned.